This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to the School of Influence podcast, where the queen and king of influencer marketing, authors and professors Amanda Russell and Neil Schaefer, cut through the noise and dissect what makes brands and professionals influential. No fluff, just the real deal.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the School of Influence podcast. Amanda, once again, another amazing guest today. And I know that you have quite a long relationship with our guest today. So I think it's appropriate that you make the introduction.
Oh, this is doing a podcast is like doing a reunion of your favorite people, actually. We are really excited to have Nigel Barker here today. And I maybe let him tell the story, but I had met him, I think it was like 10 or 12 years ago. I was trying to figure it out today in New York. And he was like very, very iconic. He actually introduced himself to me like I didn't know. I had to pretend that I didn't know who he was already. So worked with him a long time ago. But since to call him a photographer is, which is I think how most people, would you say most people know you as a photographer? Because I feel like you're like this entrepreneur businessman everywhere, but that is your core.
First of all, Amanda, thank you for having me on. And Neil, nice to meet you both and see you both again. It's been a while. But I think to be fair, Amanda, I think I sort of stalked you in the gym. I mean, the reality is...
It's very flattering. Whoa.
I have been a collector of people for many, many years of my life, pretty much all my life. And I'm fascinated with interesting and wonderful and extraordinary folk. And I remember, and I'm a big sort of gym rat just in general, right? So I was in the gym and for many, many, I mean, literally, it seems like it was probably years. It probably was only a period of 6 months because I'm pretty ballsy when it comes to making introductions. But I had been watching this extraordinary individual work out like I've literally never seen anyone work out before. I was trying to steal her moves. But if you know Amanda, you know that she's incredibly fit, in great condition, and also sort of part gymnast, part cheater. So the fact that me, sort of lumbering 6'4", 235 pounds of me, could try and imitate anything she does whatsoever is kind of a joke. But nonetheless, I was enthralled and fascinated because she's one of a kind, and I'm someone who knows a lot of top athletes. So that being said, I made the introduction, I'm always trying to photograph interesting and wonderful people, and I was doing this series called Raw, and that's R-A-W, although Amanda was more R-O-A-R, and came roaring in, and is just a personality to behold, despite her diminutive size. So, you know, don't be surprised by the fact that, you know, she's probably the size of one of my legs, but nonetheless, you know, is an extraordinary character and maybe three times the size of me.
Oh, that's so funny. It's funny to see different perspectives. I was telling you earlier that one of the things that stuck out to me, and since, you know, in that time span, I've met and worked with, you know, all kinds of different people at the top of their game in various different fields. And there's a handful that you remember. And you always struck my mind, that always stuck in my mind, because I remember, first of all, and not because I already knew that you were Nigel Barker and you had a television show and you're America's Next Top Model, all, and especially living in New York during that time, you're like, you know, just so everyone knows, and you've probably seen other podcast interviews with this title, that all the women in the gym also were very aware of who you were. So that was not why I knew you, but it was when I worked with you. And you had this, you said a few different comments, and there was like a really raw, authentic passion for what you did. And as somebody who had just, I was only very shortly out of a really devastating, like, career ending, like my running career. And so I know intensity, and to see that in something in a field I don't know at all, which was photography, I was so fascinated that I'm like, oh my God. So I wonder if people do this in finance when they're crunching numbers. Like, are they that, you know? And it was so cool to see that. And then you made a comment about how you were choosing to do, you always decided to do projects to remind yourself of why you do what you do. And I was like, let me just take a note in my brain. Let me try to model that. And I think that I have, that's always kind of stuck with me. So I would love to hear a little bit more, you know, Neil and I as well, of all the different things you do beside, because you, yes, photography, but like from photography, which was classic fashion, to like reality TV, to you, I actually recently heard that you own a gym, and I'm like, okay, next time I'm in New York, I'm going to this gym. But furniture lines, you have clothing lines, like, can you just give us a nutshell of what this all, with this Renaissance man, what are the different things in the portfolio?
There's a lot. There is a lot of different things. But in large part, it's because, and you started this conversation off by asking me, how do people know me, right? What do they know me as? And it's one of those funny things, right? You get pigeonholed and, you know, classified, so to speak, very early on in one's life. And people love to do it. It's easy for them. It's much easier for them to say, here is Nigel Barker, the photographer, or, you know, here's so-and-so, the politician, or you're a runner, or you do this, you do that. But the reality is, we're people, and majority of all of us, I would imagine, love and enjoy many different things in life and would like to do many different things in life. And we get stuck doing things, or perhaps it's just simply easier to introduce ourselves as this or that. But we're multifaceted people and beings, and we have the ability to do so many things. Our imagination is unending. We dream, we fantasize, and you know, the ability to be able to create is what fascinates certainly me. And it's however I push that and direct that passion, it's to create and make something. And so whatever it might be, whether it's furniture, whether it's filmmaking, whether it's photography, whether it's talking, you know, having a great conversation, whether it's making food, for goodness sakes, you know, your food, your meals, your all these things can be, if you wish for them to be, can be incredibly creative and fulfilling parts of one's life. And I've had that opportunity to sort of pivot many times, because I've just decided wholeheartedly that I want to do something that I didn't really have any expertise in, but I have a sort of massive passion to kind of dig deep and find out. And it's okay to mess up and not be that good, but know that you're trying really, really hard, because ultimately, at the end of the day, I only have myself to let down. So, you know, written books, including New York Times bestsellers, have a furniture company that's run for several years. And each one of these is an unusual story as to how it started, right? Photography, which I've done for years, but I actually studied biology, chemistry, physics, and maths at school. And I was destined to be a doctor. So that's a whole other side of where my training is in maths and science and what have you. But I actually always had a bigger love for the arts. I was just good at science. So the math and the science was something I was naturally good at, but my enjoyment and what I like doing were the arts. So I sort of did both and applied both. And I also found it very interesting that you know, the business parts of things, there's an art to business. There's a reason why it's a BA in arts. It's a Bachelor of the Arts in when it comes to business, right? Not a Bachelor of Science. And that's because it really is an art. And so there are so many things for me where, you know, no matter what I'm doing, I apply my creative touch to it, including fitness, the fitness world. So, you know, yes, you're right. I was one of the founders and still an owner of a gym called the Dog Pound, which we have one in New York and one in LA. I know the name and everything's ridiculous, but it all has a story. And so that's the big thing. I'm a story collector as well. So I love stories. I think the narrative behind brands and people and things and life in general, like, that's one of the most important things. It's our history. It's where we come from. And that I think is fascinating. And so that's what I'm always interested in, whatever the story is, in anything.
There's so many different questions in there. And one of the first ones is, because we do live in a time where you can do a lot of different things, a lot of people do a lot of different things, but doing a lot of different things and doing them well and doing them and being successful and making them more than like things they want to do and ideas and hobbies into actually like businesses that are making money are two different things. And so I guess my question to you is, do you feel like becoming very successful, like hyper-focusing on one thing and getting to a certain point, and that helps you then dabble into other different things? Because I feel like when somebody listening to this, and you know, I think that my students as well, would be like, well, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I don't want to just do one thing. I don't even know. And sometimes I think, is it really pigeonholing yourself? Or get really good at one thing, and then you have a more solid core. But how do you feel about that?
I think that you can never speak for everyone, or everyone, people are different. And I've met many brilliant, brilliant people over the years, and some of which one could describe as polymaths, right? People who are just simply great at so many different things. And but that being said, it doesn't make them better or more interesting than someone who's very good at one thing. And actually, it's not about collecting things. And if you are happy to pigeonhole yourself, or if you are happy to do one thing, or if one thing fascinates you and drives you, then go for it. And I'm not sure, you know, how to best describe it, but certainly in my career, I started one thing at a time, right? I started actually when I left school. Again, long story short, because I'm a lot older than probably both of you, but the reality is that I was about 17, 18. I done my A-levels. I was meant to go to medical school. I got into doing a bit of modeling back at the time. It was a long time ago. So this is the late 80s, early 90s. And I was about 50 pounds lighter and I had long hair. So you can't imagine. But that's a side story. But anyway, I did a bit of modeling to make some money to go to medical school. And what happened was one thing led to another. I met all these fascinating, extraordinary people in the fashion industry, people I'd never really met before, because I'd been at a very kind of parochial boarding school in England and had a very, you know, privileged lifestyle. And all of a sudden, there was this crazy, wonderful world of fashion and these brilliant, unusual people who had often been rejects at home and at school because they were odd and weird, and you know, they didn't fit in. But in the fashion industry, they fitted in perfectly, and they were the absolute perfect jigsaw puzzle pieces that made this beautiful rainbow. And so for me, it was, I'm like, I almost didn't fit in, but I was fascinated by following this rainbow and chasing these wonderful, extraordinary people, and wanted them to be a part of my life. So, you know, that was a big sort of changing point for me. So I got into modeling, then realized I couldn't model forever. I mean, it wasn't a real job really anyway for me. And I couldn't, as a male model, certainly it's one of the few businesses for sure for eternity has always been run by women, and women are the top of it. There are no real supermodel men and all the rest of it, right? So there was like, okay, how far can one go? And whilst I was doing that, you know, I watched photographers who were sort of any age they wanted to be and working well in it. And I'd always had a joy and an interest in photography. I'd had a camera since I was a kid. I'd been taking pictures at school. My biology teacher taught me how to print. So I had this sort of background, and I started to sort of take pictures of models. And it was not overnight. I did this as a model, first of all, for about 2 years living in Italy. I met my wife at the time and her twin sister, and they became my initial muses. And for the next several years, I followed them and chased them all around the world, trying to make sure I didn't lose the one most magnificent thing that was going to ever enter my life. And at the same time, photographing her and her friends and her sister when they would come back from jobs and say, please don't wash your hair and wash the makeup off your face. Let me capture that extraordinary new look that you have with my camera, and then, of course, take your shower and do whatever, but let me get that because it's very hard to pay for top hair and makeup and all the rest of it. And you've got the beautiful light from Paris and Milan with the Eiffel Tower and the canals of Milan in your background and all the rest of it. So I created this portfolio, but I honed my eye, and at one at a time, different things came to me. But I was able to sort of become very good at one thing, or at least best that I could be at that one thing. And then other things would come along and I would pivot, right? So then television came along and, you know, so on and so forth. And you know, as you kind of increase what you're doing, you're able to do, you know, different things. Now, to your point of how do you do multiple things, I'm someone who compartmentalizes quite well, right? So whenever I'm doing whatever I'm doing, like even right now talking to you, I'm not looking at my phone. I'm not looking over your shoulder. I'm not looking to see what's around the corner. I'm hyper-focused on you and what I'm doing right now, right here in this moment. So I don't have 100 things going on at once when I'm doing what I'm doing. I only have that one thing in front of me. So, and what that means is that you know, yes, I can then do that, but then I can switch off and do the next thing. And then if I'm making dinner, that's what I'm doing. And at that point, dinner is the most important thing in the world. And I want herbs and what spices and how am I going to cook this? And what's the timing and what's all the rest of it? I'm not simultaneously taking a phone call and asking what's going on over there. That's just not the way I operate. I'm much better when I go 100% into one thing at a time. It's not multitasking, I guess. It's a compartmentalizing. I mean, multitasking in as much as I can do many things in a day, but compartmentalizing is when I'm doing that one thing, that one task, you have my full attention.
Yeah, Nigel, I mean, you're a natural artist in everything you do. I'm really curious as to, you already talked about that transition from studying science, wanting to become a doctor, then a model, then a photographer. And you mentioned you also were taking photos since you were young. Did you ever take any professional lessons or schooling in photography, or is this something just your natural artistry you've mastered? Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
So I never went officially to school for photography. Now, the thing is too, is you have to understand that when I was a kid, there was no school for photography, right? So that sure. Didn't exist, right? So now there are many college degrees and all kinds of things that you can do with photography. In fact, my old high school that I went to, the boarding school I mentioned, just this week emailed me and said, for the very first time ever, they now have a A-level, which is the sort of, you know, the top thing you do in England before going on to university. It's your sort of final qualifications, your high school diploma or whatever. They're doing a course in photography, and there'd never been one before. So now there is an A-level in photography. So not just can you do it at college and university, but you can also study it at high school as an actual degree, as an actual A-level. Now, see, these are all new, right? So when I was a kid, it was, you know, you could be an intern or you could assist a photographer. And I didn't actually do that either. However, as a model, I worked with well over 200 photographers, including some of the best photographers in the world, right? Sort of some of the most successful photographers, whether it be sort of the Avedons or Irving Penns or Mizells or whoever it was that I was working, had the opportunity to see or work with or do some sort of job with. And at that moment, I was watching how they set up their lights, how they talked to their crew, how they related to their subject, and everything about them. I was immersed in what they did at that moment. And I remember always looking around, big eyes, what's happening around me? What am I seeing? How are they behaving? And oftentimes it was a combination of, you know, the way that they lit you or the way that they talked to you and or the ambiance or the vibe in the room, the people they brought into as the crew, everybody counted, every aspect, every little thing, every detail. And it wasn't all to make you feel good. Some of it was to make you feel uncomfortable. And that was a part of their vibe. It didn't matter. That's how they created the look and the feel of what they did. So I learned all these sort of things constantly. And when I eventually started to do it myself, it wasn't like one day I stopped and then I just did this thing. It was a gradual, right? So there was like a good year and a half, 2 years where I was both modeling and taking pictures. And then I remember when I pretty much drew a line in the sand. And when I came to the US, it was actually in 96. And it was that point that I said, okay, I'm coming to the US. I'm going to move here. And I am going to open my photo studio. I'm going to put all the money I've earned as a model. I'm going to get a place on 14th Street. It was the meatpacking district back then, and it still is called that, but it really was the meatpacking district back then. And
right.
There was a meatpacker below me, and I used to have to move the meat on a cart away from the front door every single day. And several days we'd get into sort of like almost arguments with the meatpackers because I couldn't get to my studio. And eventually we became friends, but it was a bit of a sort of a tough time. I remember even models showing up saying, you know, they'd be in their car looking out, calling me saying, I think I'm at the right place, but I'm not sure. Is this really where you are? Because there's a meat everywhere. And I, you know, how do I get to the studio? And I'm like, no, I'm here. I can see you from upstairs. Come up. And of course that area then blew up and became one of the coolest, most hip areas ever. So
I was going to say, but I was like, and now it was so fit. I thought it was so fitting that I didn't realize that you had it when it was actually, you just kept the same place on 14th Street.
Yeah.
And 9th Avenue, right? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Right across from the Apple store, which was not an Apple store. In fact, my photo studio was above a nightclub called Hell, which was an S&M gay club, which was very well known to anybody who knows the area. And so, you know, I all around there was very, very odd, cool, you know, full of artists and what have you. Now, of course, it's very bourgeois.
Yes, yes. Very fitting for the evolvement of your career.
Hey.
So in terms of like It sounds like, I mean, you've said this, that you're inspired by so much and so many. Has there been any, if you had to name sort of like a person or a couple people that are not like your family or like somebody very close to you, like it could have been somebody you met once that had such incredible impact, whether they opened a door for you that gave you like a connection that opened your world, or whether they could have opened a door and they didn't, and it made you like fired up because you just wanted to do it. You were further driven to prove them wrong. Or I guess the best question is like, was there anything that happened to you that could have really happened for you?
Many things. And that still happens. I mean, I'm still inspired by people constantly all the time that change the direction of my life and give me opportunities and inspire me to do stuff. I mean, whether it comes from simple things like, you know, I've always been inspired by Cindy Crawford. And what I mean by that is that if you look at her business model and what she's done with her life, and well, hey, you know, she's of such an extraordinary woman and brilliant and you know has and you know I wrote a book called Models of Influence, which is what became the New York Times bestseller. But part of that was the fact that there were certain people in the fashion industry, models specifically, and many of which are known as supermodels, but not all are known as that classification. But in my opinion, this is what a supermodel is. There are people who influence the industry, influence what we believe to be beauty, but also change the business and change the way we perceive fashion and created opportunities for women and for people in general of color and everything else, diversity, through their actions. And, you know, she did things too, like, for example, create her own furniture line, right? Write books. And actually how I created my own furniture line was a situation where I was shooting for this company called Art Van Furniture in the Midwest. There, I was helping them with their creative direction and catalogs. And it was a client of mine. One of their clients was Cindy Crawford and her collection. And I remember speaking to Mr. Van himself, and he was asking me for my creative vision for the new collection and what I was thinking of doing. And, you know, I had to sort of pitch what we were thinking. And I mentioned to him that one of the things I wanted to do was actually right top of the list. I said that I wanted to create my own collection of furniture. Of which he looked at me and went, "Sorry, what? What are you talking about?" And I'm like, "No, I've always wanted to do my own furniture. I've collected furniture since I was a young man. My very first paycheck I ever got, I went and bought a table, and I still own that table to this day. It's in my sitting room in there." And I said, "I've been collecting pieces of furniture my entire life. That's all I do. Is whenever I go somewhere exotic, I don't look to buy a trinket or something small, a T-shirt, or I buy one thing good, one nice thing, and I just ship it back." And I've done that all my life. So my house is full of antiquities,
so cool.
And, you know, from all over the world. And I sort of pitched it to him, and he looked at me and said, "Well, what are you talking about? You're meant to be shooting my collections, not coming up with your own collection." But the thing is, I planted a seed. And I actually said to him, "Well, you know, you have a collection from a model called Kathy Ireland, and you also have a collection from Cindy Crawford." I said, "They're both models. Now, I, for a living, see symmetry, see light, understand texture, understand color. That's what I do." I said, "I design with my eyes and create pictures for you with all the symmetry so it works perfectly within the art direction of the book. I am qualified to do this." And I said, "If you believe a model can do it, why can't a photographer?" Anyway, that was it. That conversation was over. A year later, he called me and said, "You know, a year ago, you pitched an idea of you creating a line of furniture for me." And I said, "Well, oh, yes, of course." My ears pricked up. And he said, "Well, we want to do it. How about that?" And so all of a sudden, I was in the furniture business. And it took 2 years to create the collection. I flew all over the world, worked with 6 different designers and all these ideas. And it was the most exciting thing in the world. And I got to tell you, when I shot that campaign, and I shot my own campaign, for goodness sakes, I was there in this room that we had made in the studio with these fake 4 walls. It was this extraordinary situation. I was sitting on furniture. It was an entire room. We came out with over 240 SKUs in the first collection. Now,
wow.
The entire room I was sitting on had my label, my face on a tag with the NB1 collection hanging from it. And then on the walls were my photographs. And on the table were my books. And I sat there thinking,
"I've made it."
What on earth is happening? I'm like,
my empire.
You dream it, you can make it happen. And so, you know, and at that point, I thought to myself, sky's the limit. What shall we do next, people?
That's great. Neil, did you have a question?
Yeah, no, I'm just blown away. I think there are so many elements that have, you know, brought you the success that you have. I'm really curious though, and Amanda had alluded to it as well, from model to photographer and now really full-fledged entrepreneur with various business lines. And you mentioned that business is an art as well. So what is your philosophy for making each one of these ventures that you take part in of making them profitable businesses?
The most important thing is team. Okay. And absolutely. Obviously, people know me and they see, I think I'm the face of it. But I can't possibly do it all. I have brilliant people around me. And, you know, delegation is incredibly important, and understanding how valuable your team is to you and to what you do, right? So I couldn't possibly do as many things if I didn't know that everyone around me was taking care of the things that needed to be taken care of. It started, you know, not to be trite, but obviously I mentioned my wife earlier on, but she runs my, you know, my office and my studio and takes care of all those aspects of making sure that I get from A to B. But that's incredibly important. First of all, that doesn't have to be one's wife, but it does happen to be with me. But, you know, trusting people. I have people who worked for me for years, years and years and years and years. I mean, 10, 20 years, and same people, same team. And it's very difficult for a lot of young people who often say to me, oh, can I assist you? And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't really work that way, but, you know, you can certainly try and, you know, speak to my assistants. And, you know, what happens is that there's a sort of chain of command. I speak to them, and they speak to you. It doesn't mean that you won't speak to me. I said, but it does mean that, you know, on bigger projects, that's the only way it can work. It's almost a bit like a military operation. Otherwise, it's too complicated, you know. And even with the clients, most of the time, there'll be maybe one of the clients who speaks to me. But otherwise, I ask that the clients speak to somebody else who then speaks to me, because there needs to be some kind of, not that there's a filter, but there's an aspect of a way that I can listen to all the things that are coming towards me and deal with them, especially on a photo shoot, for example, you know, which is what I'm talking about in this particular instance, because you may have three or four decision makers from a company who are there. And if they all tell you what they want to say, and what happens if you don't do that is that they oftentimes have different ideas. So one will say, oh, I like this. And the other one will say, oh, no, I like that. And then, of course, you can't please them all. And what I've always sort of tried to say to people is that you have to be, and it's hard for people to understand this, I think, but you have to be very, very confident in what you're doing. You have to be, and it's not just confidence, it's you have to like what you're doing. Because there's a, you know, you can be confident in what you're doing, but it doesn't mean that you necessarily think that people are going to like it. But I genuinely think that people like what I do. So maybe I'm mistaken. But part of the matter is that I believe it. And as long as I'm convinced, then it's sort of, then I'm going to be happy with it. And I always go work as hard as I can. I don't put things down until I think I've done the best I possibly can do. But at the same time, when I have done what the best I can do, I'm done. That's it. I don't need to do a lot more. I'm good. And that can take me 10 seconds, and that can take me 10 years. You know, it's up to when I feel like I'm done.
It's very interesting to know what projects, because I'm sure you've had a million opportunities, and it's like, what is it about certain ones that just like go, was it whether influence you or inspire, like that goes, okay, this is going to make it to the next level. This is going to be, yes, I'm in, or like, no, that's more clutter.
It rarely happens in that way. So one of the things too, is what I've never done really is waited for things to come to me. I don't really wait for someone to come to me and say, you should have a furniture line. You should write a book. You should have a television show. Life doesn't really work that way. At least it has never for me. And some people, things do just fall in their lap. But what I've done and what I've always done is looked for opportunity. I look at things and I want to get involved. I see things and I want to help. I want to do it. I want to be the one stirring the pot. I want to be the one doing, you know, making that happen. And, you know, I want to volunteer. I'm like, let me do it. And I've always been that guy. I'm like, I'll go first. You know, or I'm going last only because I want to give everyone the opportunity to go first. So I look at companies and I look at things that are out there, and I think about how I can do an advertising campaign for them, or what we can do to help, you know, launch a new product, or, you know, what am I currently doing that I would like to do more of? And for example, with the gyms, you know, that was something which was just a labor of love. I've always loved going to the gym. I've been going to the gym all my life. Fitness has always been an incredibly important part of what I do. And having worked out with this close group of my friends for several years, you know, and we had nicknamed ourselves the Dog Pound because we brought our dogs with us to the gym.
I'm wondering, I'm kind of in my head, I'm like, who's part of this crew? I wonder if I know this crowd after watching you work out in the gym.
Well, so you should, if you Google the Dog Pound or you go on Instagram and look up the Dog Pound, you'll see. But we essentially, it was a long story short, and I say that quite often because there's so many different stories here, but Hugh Jackman was training to become Wolverine. And Hugh Jackman is a friend of mine, and our kids went to school together. And he had asked me if I would work out with him. And he had a couple of other friends who were already working out with him. And I was, of course, intimidated as anyone would if sort of Wolverine asked me to work out with him. And I was like, okay. And I kept saying no, actually. I said no like three times. And finally, he sort of literally was taking no, he said no, he wouldn't take no for an answer. And actually, I think we were at the Equinox at the time.
Yes.
He came up to me and he was working out there and he was like, come on, work out with us here. And I sort of got up terrified and sort of sat there. Anyway, eventually I then went to his house and, you know, which I'd been to his home, but I was going to work out and what have you was a different thing. And I officially became a sort of a part of his little workout group. Now, we ended up making ourselves T-shirts, which had Dog Pound, and he brought his dog Dolly, I brought my dog Memphis, and we would tie him up in the gyms. And we would work out at different gyms. Now, this group grew and grew because it took him 2 years of training before he was in the condition he wanted to be to do Wolverine. And we all worked out with him. It was the best midlife crisis of our lives. Instead of like Corvette, we made ourselves look like Corvette. So, you know, and it was, you know, our wives were all delighted because, you know, we were sort of not drinking and we were on diets and we were all like sort of, you know, like couldn't have tried to look the best we could possibly ever look. And eventually when he did his role and that sort of ended, we all thought, well, okay, is this the end of the band? Is this the end of this fun trip we've just been on? And we didn't want it to be. And we thought, well, why don't we get together? There are about 14 of us at this point who would not all work out every day together, but he worked out 6 days a week. So some of us were 6 days. Some people would be whenever they could be, 1, 2, 3, 4 days a week and join the group. And we had three trainers full-time training us. And, you know, we said, okay, well, maybe we should make our own gym. And I actually found the spot in Soho. It was an old garage on the corner of Renwick Street and Canal. And we all chipped in our own money. We raised just over $1 million originally and created this gym. And we kept it quite private. And, you know, I invited people from the fashion industry and from the entertainment industry. And we soon became known as the sort of gym that was there to help transform people who had a goal to, like, to play a role in a movie at a certain point. Certainly all of the superheroes and the models who needed to be in condition for Fashion Week and campaigns. And of course, a lot of people started, anyway, it took off and it blew up and it became a phenomenon. And I became the CMO officially for launch for the first few years. And it was one of the things I was doing there and, you know, took care of their Instagram and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they now have several hundred thousand followers and what have you. And, you know, but it was a labor of love. And it was just something I'm passionate about.
The best influencer marketing campaign ever, right there, authentically. That's, yeah. I can't believe it's where it is. That's a whole separate conversation. But I would love to see you guys do a challenge, a real fit. And that was where my old apartment was, right there. So I just need to move back to New York now. So one final question would be, if you were to give advice to yourself, and something that would have given you, that you wish you had known sooner, or that would have given you a competitive advantage, what do you think, what would that be?
Oh, I mean, a competitive advantage. I feel like I've had a competitive advantage all my life. But I mean, in large part because I say yes to almost everything, but it doesn't mean I don't say no later. But I think if there was one thing that I perhaps, you know, would have tried earlier, I'm just trying to think what that might be. But, you know, there's a lot of different things in life that one needs to do. But the most important thing is having the ability to edit yourself and in order to be, you know, to understand. People are always asking everyone else's opinion and asking people, you know, certainly in this day and age, do you like what I'm doing? Do you approve? And you know, social media is a large, you know, platform, that people are constantly looking for affirmation from others. And truly to be a success, does not require that. It's a useful platform to be seen, but it doesn't make you necessarily good at anything. It's a sort of, you know, you can be liked 100 million times, but it doesn't, even in business, it doesn't always translate to sales either, by the way. And when we are looking for people who are followers of ours, you know, or followers for the businesses that I work with, it's often about who those followers are versus how many you have. Right. So, you know, that's a crucial, you know, sort of factor that people often say, well, they have a million followers. And I might be, but if you looked at who those followers are, you know, none of them buy anything. Right. So, or only 1% of them do versus this person who only has 20,000 followers, but they're all really influential, you know, and the right demographic for us. And they're actually going to purchase and they're actually our customer. So that makes a lot more sense for us to be much more targeted in that manner. You know, and of course that changes. But I mean, I guess for me would be to, that has always been the most important thing. So had I learned that earlier, and I certainly have been on a quest to understand that, and I tell people that all the time, but it's a very difficult thing to kind of get to sort of deal with and take on board, is the fact that you have to love what you do. You have to not look for acceptance from everybody else. And this is a difficult comparison, but for example, if I was to ask you who is the most, one of the most, if not the most celebrated painter of the past 100, 200 years, arguably you could say Van Gogh is one of them. Right? And his paintings have sold for some of the, you know, the highest numbers in the world. He never sold a painting in his life except to one to his sort of, you know, brother-in-law. You know, yet would you call him a failure? You know, no. He's, you know, created the most beautiful art the world's ever seen. And of course, that doesn't, it's not much solace to everyone who's sort of alive and thinks, well, God, what am I going to do for my career? But there's a deeper meaning in there, which is that, you know, you have to be passionate about what you do. You have to love what you do. You have to not care about what other people think. You can't turn around as an artist and say, should I add another sunflower to the vase? Or does this bunch of sunflowers look great? You know, Van Gogh for sure never would have said, should I put another sunflower in the vase? You know, the sunflowers he painted were sensational and he left them like that, even if no one bought them. So you have to love what you do, be confident in who you are, you know, and just believe in yourself as hard as it might be.
That's great advice to close out the interview. I was gonna ask for your advice for the listener, and I think you nailed it right there. So beautiful. What an amazing amazing interview. And I know it's going to inspire a lot of our listeners.
Well, my pleasure.
You were born to do this. And he was like, you can have your own show. You do have your own show. That's probably why you've had so many years of shows. This is why. And also, I have to add, though, that one thing I learned about you through this interview that I didn't necessarily expect, and that wasn't why we were interviewing you, was that add to your hat, like, you're a brilliant marketer. Like, some of your insights and things there's your other, you should add that. And I think you're also going to be adding teacher and professor to your jobs, because now that they have the school, right, your boarding school, I feel like that's going to be another calling. So,
well, you know what, you can check out my classes online already at Creative Life.
That's right.
Classes online. So that's and I've actually lectured a few times at different universities and stuff on photography and done masterclasses. It's a lot of fun. They are, but I think life is like that. We life is a constant lesson, and you should also be willing to be constantly taught and learn. So as you teach, you learn, and as you learn, you teach. And it's just one constant process. And certainly having children, you understand that, you know, that you're constantly helping them, but you're also learning from them. And if there's one thing a parent learns, or certainly I've learned, is that I wish I could remain like my children and have the curiosity that they have at all times, because that's what keeps us passionate and keeps us alive and keeps us in touch and makes everything exciting.
Well, thank you so much. And I just wanted to ask a lot, final, where you also have a podcast of your own called Shaken and Stirred. So where would you say, I mean, people follow you from all different angles. Where can they find you for various things?
You can find me almost everywhere. I've even got a TikTok account. How about that? If you want to see me dance.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's really what you want to see, isn't it? But, you know, but the lucky thing for me is that you can find me pretty much everywhere at Nigel Barker. So, you know, again, when you're as old as I am, you can join all these things right when they start and get your own name. but not hard to do. So thank you. Instagram, Facebook, all those things, Twitter, we have, you know, we follow along and participate and join the conversation and what have you. And, you know, I'm always looking out for great new talent, by the way. So, you know, if you've got something you'd like me to see, tag me in something and I'll check it out. And you know, we have found many great people, including multiple people who worked for me, who we literally found on Instagram and Facebook because of the things that they were doing. We just found them fascinating. And I'm always looking for wonderful new people with brilliant ideas. So please show me.
Thank you so much. This was such a wonderful interview.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the School of Influence podcast. Amanda and Neil would be honored if you spend a minute to write a review wherever you are listening to this podcast to help expose these interviews to a broader audience. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you don't miss out on future episodes. Even better, build your influence and ours by sharing this podcast on your favorite social media with hashtag School of Influence. We would love to hear from and engage with you.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.